It's great to have you joining us on Radio Free Georgia's In Tune to Nature program. I'm host Carrie Freeman, coming to you in April of 2024 from Atlanta in the Muscogee Creek Territory in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountain Range. Today, we're going to be honoring two of my favorite wildlife conservationists, Dr. Jane Goodall, the primatologist, and Dr. E.O. Wilson, the biologist. And both of them showcase how you can be a leader and continue making a huge difference in the world and being hopeful well into your 90s. And so this is prompted by the fact that Dr. Jane Goodall turned 90 on April 3rd of 2024. So I was going to play an interview with the head. His name is Rhett Butler. Yes, that's his name. The head of Monga Bay, the founder of Monga Bay News, an environmental news and podcast. And he is interviewing Jane Goodall. And she also kind of works with Monga Bay on their advisory board. So he's going to allude to that. And then I also thought, well, let's after that have a little clip. It's a PBS NewsHour clip about Dr. Wilson, who he passed away several years ago, but he was in his early 90s and was continuing to work on the Half Earth Project. And there is that organization is one of the many things about his legacy. So in honor of these great elders of the conservation world, I wanted to have us talk about them today and think about the good work they have done, lifelong work that they continue to do. So let's start with the Monga Bay podcast with Jane Goodall.
So you've been obviously working in the field for quite a number of years. What would you say is kind of the biggest change in the conservation sector since you got started?
Well, there's two big changes. One is there's more people aware. There's more little NGOs sprung up to tackle different problems. But the other change is in, you know, the harm that we've done to the natural world, the forests that are disappearing, the loss of biodiversity. So it's kind of, yes, people are more aware. And the big problem is that when people read too much of the doom and gloom, which we need to know about, which is real, but if they read too much about it, they kind of give up, like, what's the point? There's no good. So to give people hope is a very important message.
Yes, on that front, eco-anxiety is a big issue these days, especially among younger people. So how do you keep hopeful, and what is the message that you give, especially younger audiences? So
how do I keep hopeful? Because as I'm traveling 300 days a year around the world, which of course is not environmentally good because of all the emissions from planes, etc., but as nobody's given me a magic carpet, and as I think I need to be there to actually talk to people, I think that our Roots and Shoots groups, they're planting hundreds of thousands of trees, and I hope. And JGI is protecting forests. So anyway, as I go around the world, I'm meeting incredible people doing amazing things. I'm seeing forests protected. I'm seeing forests and woodlands restored. I'm meeting people who tackle what seems impossible and won't give up. And, you know, bringing endangered species that were on the brink of extinction back, like the California condor, for example. I mean, I remember vividly when there were just 12, one in captivity, and 11 wild, and they caught the 11 wild ones. They did captive breeding. And now there's what? It's over 200, isn't it?
I'm not sure, but yeah, I mean, there's definitely
flying wild. I think it's 220 or something like that.
I mean, it is a really amazing story. So I guess, like, you know, part of overcoming sort of anxiety is, I think, is feeling like you have agency to make a difference in the world. What is something that sort of like the normal person can do in their everyday life to have a positive impact?
Well, I think if people begin to realize that every day they live, they make some kind of impact. And they begin to think about their own environmental footprint. And they begin to ask questions about what they buy. Was it, when it was made, was it harmful to the environment? Was it cruel to animals like the factory farms? Is it cheap because of unfair wages or slave labor? And then don't buy it. So it might cost you a little bit more to buy something that's ethically produced. But if it costs a little bit more, you will value it more and you will waste less. And as you know only too well, human waste is a huge, huge problem. So basically the message is just remember, everybody, every day you live, you make an impact. Choose wisely.
And sometimes we need to sort of move people who are sort of higher up the food chain. So political leaders and business leaders. So how would the average person in their daily life sort of get their message to those kind of people?
Well, I think it depends. I'm not sure who the average person is.
Okay.
But people have, you know, different ways of operating. There are campaigns, petitions, things that one can sign. I always hope that our youth program, you know, many of the young people's parents are in decision-making positions. And I know that youth can influence older people. It's happened again and again.
And you, you're about to embark on a new campaign looking at how people can exercise their vote in terms of influencing things. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I gather that there are 50 countries around the world that are having elections, not all presidential, but elections. And, you know, I know for a fact that a lot of particularly young people don't want to vote because they don't particularly care about anybody who's out there. They don't feel that there's any use voting for anybody. So I think the main message is your vote matters. Please go and vote and just pick the candidate who cares about the future. That's the key message. But your vote matters. Please, please vote.
Well, so if you were looking for a way to sort of like rally people around the idea of protecting wildlife, through an event or some other mechanism, is there something you have in mind or you would envision?
Well, I think, you know, the important thing, people will never really rally around to protect nature unless they understand it, unless they experience it. And that's why getting children involved as early as you possibly can. And I've seen the result, you know, and there are so many stories of young people who they've been maybe in the inner city. They haven't had a chance to get their hands in the earth. They haven't had a chance to see what's in a river or a stream. And so if you can manage to find a way for them to experience nature firsthand. And, you know, the interesting thing is that more and more studies coming out to show that being in nature is beneficial psychologically and physically. So in Canada and Japan, and maybe other countries, but those two I know, doctors can prescribe time in nature. And so when you think about that, that's kind of fascinating. And it just shows that this era now with AI and cell phones and social media, and our children are getting more and more of, like, you see them going through a beautiful place, and they're just looking fixated on their, you know, social media or whatever it is. And that's shocking. That's what we try with our Roots and Shoots program. We try to get them out into nature without their cell phones. Difficult.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a different world. I mean, the reason I started Manga Bay was really because I had those experiences out in nature, and certainly harder these days. So, I mean, this is kind of maybe a weird question, but I'll try to ask it. To what do you credit people's interest in you and your work?
Well, to start with, it was young girl going out into the forest when no other young girls did, and studying chimpanzees. It was kind of like, you know, the Geographic, et cetera, made it Beauty and the Beast. And that just captured people's attention. That was a good start for me. And then this, I mean, there's two Janes, Rhett. This one talking to you now, just me, you know, just But then there's an icon that's built up by geographic and discovery and media and blah, 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 whatever. And this Jane has a job keeping up with the icon. And it's because, you know, I can't get through an airport now. So you ask me, what is it? I'm honestly not sure. Maybe you can tell me, can you?
I mean, I think it's your origin story, but then the fact that you moved from being a researcher to being an advocate for wildlife and animals, and especially conveying the idea that animals are a lot like us. They have emotions, they have feelings, which, you know, wasn't, I mean, as you know, was not a mainstream idea when you started promoting it, and people, you know, maybe ridiculed for you or criticized you for it. But now the world's kind of caught up to your thinking. So I think people recognize that and appreciate it. And the fact that you're out there every day, meeting with people and giving them hope about what's could easily be seen as a doom and gloom sort of space. So, I mean, that would be my take on it, I think.
But it's, you know, for me, it's, I've never really, I can't reconcile what's happened. Really, I don't truly understand it, but I will make use of it. It's useful for the effort to save the planet if people care about you and therefore want to listen to what you say.
What would you say you most want to be remembered for?
Two things. One, starting Roots and Shoots and giving people hope, especially young people, and getting young people involved in the natural world. Secondly, because when Lewis Leakey, my mentor, told me I had to get a degree, he said, Jane, I picked you, and this was back in 1957, I picked you to study chimps because you hadn't been to university and your mind had not been contaminated by the very reductionist opinion of the science back then towards animals. But now I want scientists to take you seriously. So you have to get a PhD. And we don't have time for an undergraduate degree. I've got your place in Cambridge University to study ethology. Well, I didn't know what ethology was, study of behavior, but I hadn't been to college. So I was nervous. And imagine how I felt when all these erudite professors told me I'd done everything wrong. Chimpanzees, you shouldn't name them. You should give them numbers. You can't talk about their personality. You can't talk about them having a mind capable of making decisions, solving problems. You absolutely can't talk about them having emotions like happiness, sadness, fear, despair. Those are all unique to humans. That's how they thought. But I'd had this wonderful teacher when I was a child, my dog. You can't have a dog, a cat, a rat, a bird, or I don't care what, and not know we're not the only sentient, sapient beings on the planet. And because the chimps are biologically so like us, like we share 98.7% of the composition of DNA, and because their behavior is so like ours, kissing, embracing, holding hands, patting one another, males competing for dominance, standing upright, swaggering, shaking a fist, you know, lips bunched in a furious scowl. Remind you of some male politicians, right?
Really?
And, you know, the long childhood, the observational learning, as well as experience, of course. So gradually, science had to change its attitude. And once chimps had opened the door, okay, we're not the only sentient, sapient beings, that opened the door to all the others. And so now, you know, we're studying, finding out about the intelligence of rats and pigs and the octopus, not just elephants, whales, and dolphins. So I think it's the most exciting time for young people wanting to learn more about animal behavior that there's ever been.
So turning to conservation generally, is there an underappreciated or overlooked area that you feel like if it got more attention or was addressed, it could have a major impact in the world?
Well, more and more of these things are coming into the mainstream, like corridors, the importance of wildlife corridors, either small ones and letting, I mean, just a simple thing like letting natural vegetation grow along the side of roads and greening, urban greening. That's becoming more and more talked about. And then there's, you know, permaculture and regenerative agriculture. People understanding that this industrial farming is killing the soil. It's harming biodiversity. When it comes to farming animals, it's horribly cruel. And that this industrial farming is producing masses and masses of CO2 and methane. People are beginning to realize these things. But the killing of the soil is something I think a lot of people haven't grasped the importance of soil. I think people don't really understand how much we depend on the natural world for food, for air, for water, all the rest of it. But what we depend on is a healthy ecosystem, that complex mix of plants and animals, everyone with a role to play. And I see that as like tapestry. And so each species is like a thread in this tapestry, and they're all interdependent. So as you pull out a thread, as a species disappears, and then you pull out another thread, and in the end, the tapestry hangs in tatters, and the ecosystem collapses. And that's what's happening, and that's what we depend on, healthy ecosystem.
Do you kind of have a guiding principle that you've kind of carried through your life and work that you would convey to people?
Or is respect?
Like respect for other species, respect for other people?
Respect for people and other animals and the environment.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
Respect's very important.
I like that a lot too, because that's exactly my guiding principle. So appreciate that. So the conservation space has this reputation of not being very collaborative sometimes, at least between certain big NGOs. What do you think, like, why do you think those barriers exist, and what do you think could be done to sort of make them play better together?
I think that the NGOs are competitive, and they don't want to work with another NGO in case they help that other NGO get more money than they do. But you know, Red, I've come to think of humanity as at the mouth of a very long, very dark tunnel, and right at the end is a little star shining, and that's hope. But it's no good sitting wondering, you know, when's that star coming? No, you've got to. I don't know quite what the biblical expression gird your loins is, but I love it. You've got to gird your loins, roll up your sleeves, and crawl under, climb over, work around all the obstacles that lie between us and the star. There's climate change, loss of biodiversity, poverty, because people in poverty destroy the environment to survive. Killing of the soil, industrial agriculture, fossil fuel burning, you know, go on and on and on and on. Good news, there's people working on every single one of the problems.
Is there a story that you haven't told very often or haven't told in a while that you would want to tell?
Oh, golly, what story? Well, there's a story I love about Roots and Shoots. And it was the first group in the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, where JGI has an office, the eastern part, Goma, which is where all the minerals are. So there's always conflict, you know, different militia come in. And so this little group of young people, they were sort of 10 to 12. And for their first project, they'd seen a hill, and they were told that hill used to be sacred and covered in trees, and now most of the trees have gone. So they want to put the trees back. So their mentor, Dario, realized that, well, it's much bigger than the children think, but he didn't want to damp their enthusiasm. So he got a forester friend to donate some little saplings. Then he had to go to the resident militia, and he asked the head guy, you know, was this okay? And he said, well, it's stupid, but I suppose there's no harm in it, but you'll have to take soldiers with you. So you imagine these 15 little children clutching their saplings and I suppose something to dig with. And it's a long journey, much longer than they thought, and it's hot. When they get there, the ground is hard. And with them, four big Congolese soldiers with AK-47s over their shoulders. And so after about 10, 15 minutes, the youngest is a little girl, she's about 9. She starts to cry. And a little while after that, one of the soldiers leans his gun against a tree and goes to help her. And within the next 15 minutes, all the soldiers have left their guns and they're helping the children plant trees. And to me, this is so symbolic of what we're trying to do. Because, you know, we can't solve all the environmental problems while people are fighting each other.
Yeah, that's a really powerful story.
I hope you enjoyed listening to that Manga Bay News interview with Jane Goodall. She really is an inspiration to me and so many others. And in honor of her continuing to be a leader into her 90s, I was thinking of another conservationist who worked through into his 90s that made a very big difference for animals and nature, and that's biologist E.O. Wilson. And this is an interview that I'm going to play from the PBS NewsHour with Jeffrey Brown as the journalist interviewing Wilson. And this was from 2016. And I think he was in his late 80s then. And unfortunately, Dr. Wilson passed away in 2021 at age 92. But he had written the Half Earth Project, saying we should protect half the earth, or give over half the earth, land and sea, to sharing it with other animals, every other species, not just dominating it by humans. And in this PBS interview, he'll explain why we really have to do that to protect all of life on earth, because we can't keep going with this extinction rate. So he's pretty inspirational. Here's the interview.
Next, scientist and two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning author Edward O. Wilson first gained fame for his study of ants. Through the years, he's moved from small insects to big ideas, and now a very big one, one made more urgent by the problems of climate change. Jeffrey Brown has our profile in his second report from Southern Alabama.
I was just a 12, 13-year-old boy, and it was just a wonderland to me.
Edward O. Wilson spent his formative years in Mobile, Alabama, looking for snakes and insects in the surrounding delta.
If I could, I would just do the same thing today that I did then, but it would look funny.
The experience would shape him as biologist, evolutionary theorist, naturalist, and at age 86, perhaps most important to him now, conservationist.
What is man? Storyteller, mythmaker, and destroyer of the living world.
His new book, Half Earth, Our Planet's Fight for Life, takes on nothing less than the survival of plant and animal life on Earth.
Yearning to be more master than steward of the declining planet.
Wilson's solution is in the title, setting aside half the Earth as natural habitat. We spoke beneath the old live oak trees at Fort Blakely Historic Park, where Wilson's great-grandfather fought in one of the last battles of the Civil War.
Half Earth. Are you serious?
I'm serious. I know it sounds radical, but we must have it if we're going to save most of the species remaining on Earth. And it's easier to do than most people might think.
It sounds impossible. Well, sounds for some people crazy.
I was just going to use the word insane.
Yeah.
Yes, it sounds that way because they envision cutting the Earth into two hemispheres, one for us and one for the other 10 million species. But no, we mean giving 50% or setting it aside patches, some large wilderness areas, others far, far smaller, in order to make that amount of reserve area.
Your ideas on this, on what should happen, have gotten bigger and bolder.
Well, they have. My alarm went from yellow to red when I read the papers authored by large numbers of scientists in team effort that showed how far off the goal we, the conservation organizations, were, all our efforts around the world in slowing down extinction rates.
One key to Wilson's argument is how little we know of life on Earth. Only 2 million species identified out of a total probably closer to 10 million, even as species go extinct at 1,000 times the normal rate, thanks chiefly to human population growth and corresponding habitat loss. Conservation efforts worldwide have thus far set aside a little more than 15% of the Earth for habitat. Wilson would triple that.
We would be taking a first step toward securing enough space and natural habitat to preserve, by my estimate, more than 80% of the species left. If we don't do this, we're going to go down to 50% or more in a fairly short period of time in this century.
Wilson's attempting such a thing right here, to give national protection, either a park or wildlife refuge status, to parts of the Mobile Tensaw River Delta, one of the most biologically diverse areas in North America. There's opposition in this conservative state, but Wilson is not deterred.
I think it's a moral thing to do. I believe morality is going to enter very strongly into what I hope will be a shift of perception and precepts and reasoning about this, that we really should take extra measures to save the rest of life on Earth. And who are we, one species, to wipe out a majority of the species that live with us on this planet just for, without even thinking about it, for our particular selfish needs?
Wilson acknowledges that the world's population will continue to grow from its current 7.3 billion to around 11 billion before leveling out. But he thinks advancement in technology will help shrink our ecological footprint.
So what are the stakes?
The stakes are the future of life, the future of the living part of the environment. Mind you, we are beginning to make meaningful progress toward controlling the forces of climate change and of pollution. And the other parts of the non-living environment that's been causing a large part of the destruction. If we allow the living part of the environment to disappear, for me, it will be by future generations regarded as one of the most catastrophic, even evil, periods in human history, for our descendants to look back and say they wiped out half or more of all of the rest of life on Earth, the variety of life on Earth.
A thoroughly depressing prospect, but to spend a day with Edward Wilson is anything but depressing.
I hope you enjoyed listening to Dr. E.O. Wilson as much as I did. One thing that strikes me is both Dr. Wilson and Dr. Goodall are scientists, but they do not shy away from talking about ethics and morality and what we should do, and having empathy for other animals and respect for other life. And I love that they've become advocates, because they realize they had to. You just can't publish papers. You actually have to get out there and try to save nature and the habitats, the livelihoods of other animals, really, but that we all depend on. And if you're interested in finding out more about either of their organizations, you can check out the Half Earth Project, or there's also the Jane Goodall Institute. And I just wanted to end by saying, I find them both, Dr. Goodall and Dr. Wilson, very inspirational, because should we all be so fortunate as to live into our 90s, I hope we're all able to follow our heart and our passion and still make a big contribution to the world. And this reminds us to always involve our seniors and our elders and listen to the wisdom that they have to share, lifelong wisdom. So I hope that's inspirational for you as it was for me. So thank you for listening to In Tune to Nature. The views and opinions expressed on In Tune to Nature do not necessarily reflect those of WRFG, its board, staff, or volunteers. I'm one of their volunteers. I'm host Carrie Freeman. I'm asking you to please support independent radio like WRFG at wrfg.org and to take care of yourself and others, including other species. Thanks for listening. Cheers.